guys. I'm fantasy author J.H. Fleming.
And I'm science fiction and fantasy author Philip Dreher Duncan. And with us this evening, we have one of our favorite people. She is a musician and an author and a podcaster, so she'll fit right in with us. Hello, Olivia.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Very excited to have you on. And Olivia is in Florida right now hanging out because she's doing Ren Fairs. Why ever would you be at a Ren Fair?
I perform with a group called Music the Gathering, which is a trio, sometimes a quartet, that has been made infamous by being written about by J.H. Fleming.
I don't Never know heard, of her.
Heard of her. Yeah. So I feel honored to be on here, both as a writer myself and as the semi-inspiration for a character, so absolutely honored in that respect.
That's how I should have introduced you. I should have said our first druid on the podcast.
Yes.
All right, so also I just got to get this out of the way because we've seen Music the Gathering a million times, and we might be a little biased, but they are tremendous. And if you have a chance to catch them at a Ren Fair or anywhere, really, they are amazing. And then you watch them and you're like, what? They're so good. And then you buy the books and you're like, what? This is so good. It's a whole thing.
Oh, absolutely. And then something we've seen here in Florida, because I think it's the first festival that we've done recently where people are seeing the second book for the first time. The number of people who have up and been like, oh my God, there's a second one. I loved the first one.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
I was going to say it's funny because usually as like it starts getting closer to the Muskogee Ren Fair, my brain is weird and starts dreaming about the Ren Fair. And that just started like this week and you guys featured in it. So that was fun.
Amazing. Oh, yes.
Well, not really. It's super creepy. She told me about it. You should be weirded out. No. I'm a little weirded out about it.
Liar.
Nightmare Music the Gathering.
I had a very vivid dream last night that had nothing to do with the Ren Fair. It was this really vivid dream that that JH and I were being chased by something, and it turned out to be aliens. And we somehow defeated this alien, and then we jumped like 5 years in the future, and we were renowned alien hunters, and we'd written books about hunting aliens. It was like the weirdest, super long, creepy dream. I don't know.
So is that prophecy?
I mean, it would be an interesting life. Yeah.
Or is it at least half sure. prophecy that now you're going to write about being alien hunters, even if you aren't that in reality?
I could do that. That could be fun. That could be fun. All right. Well, what else is new with Music the Gathering?
With Music the Gathering, we are doing one new full-length festival this year. We are doing the Bristol Renaissance Festival up in Wisconsin, right near Chicago.
Nice.
We did only a couple weeks of that last year, so now we're doing the full run there. And then we are also returning to what is somewhat of a home fair for us. We're going back to the New York Renaissance Festival, which I haven't been working at in over 10 years.
Oh, wow.
So that'll be a fun homecoming.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
But you also have lots of other things you're working on right now, too. I mean,
indeed, yes.
Both of you, you and JH, both of you like do so much stuff that I'm just like over here just writing my little books like y'all are crazy. So you're working on a novel. So we'll talk about the podcast first. So you just launched a podcast. You're in your fourth episode.
Yes, I just did my fourth episode. I'm trying to do one a month. I already got a little funky with that and did two in February, but I launched it in November and it's called Folk Files. And essentially, I love learning things about the songs that I'm performing, things like whether it's old wives' tales or the actual history of the song or things that connect to themes in the song. So, for example, my third episode was all about Mingalay Boat Song. And so some of it was about the actual history of the song, but a ton of it was about the history of the island of Mingalay, which is absolutely bonkers and filled with sheep, both the island and the history of the island. So I decided after actually talking on a different podcast about this, Ren Talks, the sort of Renaissance Festival industry podcast, and lots of people thought, oh yeah, they commented that they were really interested in it too. I decided to go for it, with a lot of support from my partner, Aaron J. Morton, who was like, I will show you exactly how to do it. And then you should do it. I said, thank you so much, because I know nothing about, you know, audio production or anything like that. So yeah, I'm on my, I'm working on the fifth episode right now.
Very nice. And how much time goes into that for the research side of it? Because you're very thorough.
Thank you. Yes. I haven't timed myself. I feel like that's something I should do for if I like monetize it down the road and need to know how many hours I'm actually putting into it, but it is a lot of work. It ends up being about a 25 minute long episode, but that's using maybe a third of the material that I come across. Oh, wow. And I also write out and sort of draft out exactly what I'm going to say, because I discovered something really interesting about myself, which is that the very first episode I wrote or did, I gave it to Aaron. He was the first person to listen to it. And he goes, yeah, I think that it should be fully off the cuff, because I could tell that you were reading in the first half and it didn't seem as natural as the second half. And I said, that's really funny, because the first half was improvised and the second half was written out. And he goes, then never mind, write the whole thing. So now I carefully draft out the whole thing.
That's amazing.
It's not the first time I've been told that me being off the cuff sounds more robotic than me reading from a piece of paper.
I can sympathize with that.
This is why I don't go too in depth with our show notes, so that I don't become too robotic by having too in-depth show notes. That's why I like to keep them light, so that we're freestyling the whole time and sound real. Or I'm, you know, lazy and I ran out of time and I was like, make better show notes or have a grilled cheese sandwich for dinner. I'm like, grilled cheese.
Yeah, you don't want to be hangry during the podcast.
That's right. That is not good, especially when we have a long one and we end up recording for like 2 hours. And it's like, oh man, it's like bedtime and we still haven't eaten. Yeah.
Oof. I don't know how you guys, if you guys have written a sort of academic paper since school much, but I've done it once or twice for just like academic programs that I've been part of, but I didn't realize how much I missed it. Just writing a simple, you know, 5-page paper on a topic that you really enjoy, which sounds like the dorkiest thing in the world. But like this most recent one that I did, it was the first one that I wrote out a full bibliography for it, because the rest of the episodes, while I was using certain sources, a lot of it was just things that I knew from talking to people. So it didn't really make sense to write out a whole bibliography. But this most recent one had way too much information not to. And I had this nostalgic, warm feeling writing a bibliography. And it was so dorky.
I actually don't hate that. People would probably think that knowing my fiction. But before I actually started writing fiction, I got into this like site where I was writing these articles or whatever. And I have it framed. Somebody reached out to me because I did this whole like series of like one or two pagers about various like samurai like that actually lived and like some of their history and things. And some game show in Japan came across it and they were looking for Westerners who knew about samurai to be in this game show. And so they actually put me in like the preliminaries and I had to be interviewed and like go through a quiz. And then I lost and I failed, but it was still pretty cool.
That's awesome. Yeah. Fun connection to that, because you were mentioning that me and JH are always doing like tons of stuff. Myself and the other members of Music the Gathering are currently dabbling in taiko. So we are learning a lot about the history of samurai through taiko drumming.
Oh, that's cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just over here writing books. I'm just writing my little books and staying in my little corner. The rest of you are all taking over the world.
Corner in my own little chair.
Yeah, pretty much. Have you considered, you know, like, so if you're writing everything down for Folk Files, have you considered, you know, because you're doing like one a month, so have you thought about like maybe when you get to the end of the year compiling them and you could do a book, like a nonfiction Folk Files book?
Ooh, I have not thought of that. I have thought about just putting it, like putting together a website and having them all written out for people who don't like listening to podcasts, but I never thought to actually put it in print. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that could be cool.
Yeah.
Be fun.
Yeah. Absolutely. You could probably go into a lot more depth with some of the stuff you ended up cutting out of the episodes as well.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
a good point.
Yeah, you could do one for like every year that you keep it going, right? Mm-hmm. Like a year one, a year two, something. Be fun.
Yeah. Oh, I love this idea.
I mean, I would buy that.
Yes, you would. Yes, you would. even if you didn't know Olivia, would. You would. Yeah.
I would.
That tracks.
That's good to know.
All right, so you were also diving into, when I guess you've done some fiction writing in your past, but right now you're working on what I guess would be your first published fiction writing. Is that right?
Yes. So I am currently working sort of in tandem on two different novels that I've written getting published. One of them I won't talk about because it was ghostwritten. I ghost wrote it, but then the other one is for my band called Gumshoe Noir, mm-hmm. which is sort of, it began as the creation of Jonathan Tucker, who I know you both know, who performed with the musical Blades and Chance the Arm and Kansas City based. And he had this idea of having this sort of film noir-esque detective music, mm-hmm. because that doesn't really exist as a genre. You've got jazz, you've got sort of more dark cinematic stuff, but we wanted to see what would happen if we just have the idea in mind of this is, you know, it has suspense to it. It has everything that noir is, and noir is so difficult to be, you can't really define it that well. There's a cynicism to it, there's a suspense to it, but it's really hard to nail down. So when we first wrote our music album, we every week consumed something that was considered noir from many different time periods, many mm-hmm. different media and genres and stuff like that. So everything from Twin Peaks to Maltese Falcon mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So you got everything in there. And then we created this album that has some electronica, some jazz, everything all over the place. And for that first album, I took all of the songs that we created and then essentially made like a jukebox Penny Dreadful out of it.
Okay.
So I wrote through social media. I had basically a chapter a week where I was just piecing together these songs into a crime story, some sort of mystery. Mm-hmm. And now we're working on our second album, but we said this one would be the other way around. So Jonathan asked me to write this ghost story because we wanted it to be sort of a supernatural thing as well. And it's called A Story of One Story. And JH, it was very kindly my editor for it. And it's basically follows, it's this one story house in a city. And so I don't know if either of you ever read that story. What is it? The Little Red House or something like that? The children's book about the house and then the city just like grows up around it.
Oh yeah, maybe so. Yeah.
Yeah. And my idea was what happened if that house went sour and went evil? And so it has this, it's a combination of a first person narrative from this guy who has hired Gumshoe Noir to figure out what's going on with this house. But it also does flashbacks to the lives of all these ghosts who are haunting the house. And it also dives into the case files of Gumshoe Noir, which is myself and Jonathan. So mm-hmm. it's funny. Once again, I exist in somewhat fictional form in a book.
Yes.
And I say somewhat fictional because we were talking earlier about, you know, there are little snippets like, oh, Olivia has written a lot of romance novels and has never published them. She has punished them by not publishing them. And I was like, yes, that is correct.
You know, once you've written enough books, they deserve to be punished. Some books just don't behave and they must be punished. Yeah, I think you should do something with your romantasy, your old romantasy books. Why not?
Yeah, they've already been adapted in a certain kind of way because I only shared them with close friends mm-hmm. because they were originally written on a dare, basically write a fantasy romance novel and then they turned into something else. And I shared them with close friends who then, as a gift to me on Valentine's Day, read all of the steamiest scenes in weird accents and then sent me those sound files. So we already have an adaptation.
That's amazing. Oh my gosh.
Oh, that's great. That's like the, I can't think of the name of the actor, though. He's got a, like, a very unique voice.
Oh, Gilbert Gottfried.
Gilbert Gottfried, yeah. They have him reading 50 Shades of Grey.
Amazing.
So funny.
Yep. I love that.
So you, so it sounds like you've been writing for a long time, but this is really... right now the first time you're really like pursuing publication and things. So what's that been like, learning this whole new thing?
It is a process of learning what I need to learn.
Yeah,
because there's so much that I don't even know where to get started. And so I feel like this, you guys' podcast is such a great resource.
Oh, thank you.
You yourselves are an amazing resource. I know I've nudged JH so many times about stuff like this, like knowing what software exists for helping you format, what exactly you do with your finished thing. I was talking to my cover artist the other day and I was like, okay, thank you. Yes, that looks great. Pass me over the file and send me an invoice. And she's like, well, don't you need stuff on the back? Like, or
oh,
don't
yeah.
you need people to know you wrote it, or stuff on the spine or anything, any writing whatsoever? And I said, oh yes, I will get back on that. I just completely forgot that that was a necessary piece of it.
Yep.
So it really is like learning what I need to know. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like learning the shibboleths of publishing.
Mm-hmm.
Even little things, like I noticed going through your edits, that like basically the etiquette around an M dash is seems so specific to me, and I'm just completely clueless about that. So there's a lot of that. But I think a lot of it is also, and I don't know if either of you felt this way before becoming authors, but when I was growing up, it seemed like all my friends wanted to be a writer in the same way that all my friends wanted to be an actor. Mm-hmm. And so it felt almost like, oh, all of us are expected to have this dream, but none of us are actually going to achieve it because it's just like too many fish in the pond.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until recently that I was like, why did that deter me? Why did I think, oh, everyone wants to publish a novel, so I shouldn't? You know, it's such an interesting way to think. But that was me for 33 years of my life.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pursuit that, like, is driven on self-doubt. like writing thrives on self-doubt.
Yeah, I was going to say, it has that similarity, for me at least, with music. Like, both of them have that same sort of like self-doubt and like, oh, everyone wants to do this and I'm not good enough, you know, all those things that go along with it, and you know, all the different learning curves for both of them as well. Like, I'm still learning stuff about music production and things, like, I don't know what I'm doing. But
well, ironically, you guys have kind of flipped.
Yeah.
I was thinking how fun it is that you and I have both in different directions done the accompanying album to novel thing, and it was so cool when your album came out. I was so excited about that. Because I remember all the times you would come up to, you know, the booth and be like, and oh no, it would be you, Phil. You'd say something like, you know, JH, she can sing. And I'd be like, why have you told us this before and sent us all of your dulcet tones? And then we got little snippets of you singing, and now we've got a full album. So that's excellent.
Yeah. Thank you again for being on it. I love the way all the songs turned out with you guys. It was so good.
Yeah. I'm honored you'd asked me. Thank you.
Yeah. That is definitely one of my favorite ones. Like, your guys' voices meshed together really nicely for that. So that was super good. And yeah, this writing thing, once you like, I mean, it's, I guess it's easy when you're just like, I'm just going to write. And then when you're actually like, I'm going to publish now, you're like, oh, this is so much more than I thought it was going to be. Like, I did the same thing, right? I actually hired this, I went and found this artist who is incredibly, incredibly talented. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he's incredibly, incredibly talented. And I hired him to do a book cover for me. And neither of us thought about the spine or back cover matter. And he did this beautiful, beautiful piece of art that stretched from front to back. And he had to go back and like cover over like a big part of this beautiful work he'd done so that we could put the back matter in. And I felt so stupid for not telling him, and he felt stupid for not doing it. And it was just like, well, I guess we're learning together.
Oh. Yeah, I'm lucky that I'm working with Lydia Hull, who J.H. has worked with on the Music the Gathering novels. So she's been through it before, so she can guide me.
There you go.
Yeah, she's got a couple down now.
Mm-hmm. She's extraordinary. All I said was like, here's a picture of a house that you can vaguely base this off of. This is the kind of the vibe we want. Go ahead. And then she gets back to me like 2 months later. She goes, sorry, it took me a little while. I was studying a lot of architecture. And she's created this whole city street with like a different kind of townhouse for each townhouse. It's amazing.
That's cool.
Awesome.
Well, and then you realize too, like, oh, I've got to write the back cover matter, and learning to do that is not easy. Like, that's a whole science of its own, right? So
yeah,
it's tricky. There's a lot to it.
Yeah. Phil's really good at that stuff.
I am somewhat passable at it.
Wise.
I have a cheat code. Shout out Brian Cohen. So there's actually, he's a podcaster. He's a very well-known writing podcast. His name's Brian Cohen, and he put together this he's really good and really known for writing back cover matter. And so he put together this like sort of cheat sheet guide, and that's what I use to write my back cover matter. But we actually met him just a few weeks ago, and I told him that, and I told him thanks, and I showed him what I did, and he went through it, and he's like, oh, not bad, but fix this, 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 and this. I was like, yeah, I'm not that good at it.
So you go to the master and he has critique, so you're not good at things. Got it.
Nailed it. This whole industry is driven on self-doubt.
I actually, I don't know if you guys have talked about this or used this tool at all, but last year I did The Artist's Way. Have either of you done that or chatted about it at all?
I don't think so.
Sounds familiar.
But yeah, I was going to say it sounds familiar, but I can't pick.
It's a 12-week self-guided course to basically get uncreatively blocked.
Oh, wow.
And but a lot of it is just addressing self-doubt to the point where you feel okay showing people things.
Oh, wow.
I feel like that's the main gift that the course gives you. And just saying, like, you're going to feel like garbage and you're going to feel like you don't want to show anybody anything. But that's not fair to the creativity flowing through you, is it?
Yeah, people, I thought about this today because I saw one of the writing groups I'm in like Facebook or wherever. Somebody was talking about like, how do you get a thick skin? How do you toughen up? And I'm like, oh, how? That's a whole, like, I could do a whole podcast on just that. But like, I start by putting my worst reviews on my business cards, which I hand my peers, you know, like, which works really well because it makes them laugh. And, it, like, people, I've met a lot of people like at conventions because they'll just be like, oh my gosh, you got to see his business card. Like, you got to meet this guy and see his business card. But it is, it's like literally, that's what I carry around at the conventions and stuff. My actual card with my books on it and my contact info has my worst reviews, and people think it's hilarious. And if somebody laughs, then that's good enough, right? Like, it's fine.
Mm-hmm. While researching my podcast, I discovered something cultural with music that helped me with writing, which is that a lot of cultures, I specifically found it first through Native American cultures, especially out, I was specifically looking at ones in the Pacific Northwest region. When they talk about music, it never has attribution. Music, and it, a lot of times there isn't actually a word for music because it's just something that is done in many areas of your life. There is song that happens with hunting. There's song that has happened with harvesting. It's just so ever present that there's no real word for it. And if you are singing a song and it's just come to you, you are not the creator of that song. You are the carrier of that song.
Interesting.
And I think that's really helpful when sharing creative work, because if you're like, oh, this has come to me, I am now carrying it, I need to carry it to the next person. Mm-hmm. And hey, if they drop it and they hate it, oh, I was just the one who carried it to them. That's okay. It seems like so much of an easier way of thinking about it.
No, I like that. I think also one of the things that I've noticed, and actually doing the podcast has brought this more to light to me maybe than anything else has, just from talking to all the different authors and things, is having some like anchor points to like, how do I put it? Like, so we had a friend on, Bill Ledbetter, and he'd won a Nebula, which is a very big science fiction award. And it was kind of like, you know, he has that like on his wall, and it's like, you know, if you ever have self-doubt, you turn around and you see like, no, I won a Nebula. Like, I did do that, right? Or like in my case, like seeing my, like my anchor point right now is just the amount of like good reviews and how they've gone up on one of my series is like, this many people definitely liked it. This many people definitely did not hate it. Right. Mm. So I think that having those is good too, to like claw yourself back out of it. Like, no, I did have this success. These people liked it, you know?
Mm-hmm. I have a Google Doc with every screenshots of every nice thing that's been said about my podcast, because I know that psychologically we will remember the bad stuff. Mm-hmm. If someone says something mm-hmm. bad, there's no need to write it down. We're going to remember it. Whereas mm-hmm. the good stuff, there's always the, well, are they just saying that, blah, 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 blah. So I have it all to reference whenever I'm in an icky place.
Oh, that's good. It's a great idea.
Do you know what JH does when she's in an icky place?
What?
She says, take me to Red Lobster. I want Cheddar Bay biscuits.
Yes.
I did that. I had a not so great day yesterday, writing related. And that was my way of kind of coping with it. Like, I need to get away from everything for a minute. And so I had shrimp and Cheddar Bay biscuits, and it was wonderful.
I approve.
I did as well. I ate so much shrimp. It was bad. They should not be doing the endless shrimp year round. That is not good.
I'm curious. They had these new shrimp flavors, and I'm probably a weirdo because I love them. It's a crusted salt and vinegar shrimp, and I freaking love it. So it's supposed to be like limited time though. So I don't know how long they'll be there.
This conversation is reminding me of a great writing exercise that Mark, my bandmate, and his bandmates in a delightful band called Three Dudes Tootin' did together.
Sounds like a band he would be in.
It's at the Dirty Stage at the Brevard Renaissance Festival, and they have a whole song about like intestinal distress. And they set each other the writing workshop of they had to each start their verse with 3 a.m. time for shrimp.
Oh my God.
So each of their verses always starts with that line.
Oh, wow.
Oh, what a...
That's amazing.
That's a lovely place for us to finish the segment and switch to the news. Time for the news. That's not actually our news theme song. Anyway, for the news this week, we're going to start with there are some changes with Kindle Vella. I don't really know what any of that means because I've never used it, but I'm going to try to explain it. Apparently, one of the changes is now the first 10 episodes will be free. I don't know what it was before, but whatever it was, it's now going to be 10. And then it also says the 200 free token offer for new readers will end. So apparently they were given tokens for readers. I don't know. I don't know what the tokens are, even, to be honest with you. I'm totally winging this. But I feel like anybody who uses Vella probably needs to know that this has happened. And then the last change is all paid episodes will require 10 tokens to unlock. So those are the new changes for Vellum. Does it say when?
Not Vellum, Vella.
But he said Vellum, didn't I? That's funny. Vella.
You said Vellum.
I'm dumb. Yeah. Me no talkie.
Yeah, the way I understand it, Vella's the one that's like the serialization, right?
Yeah, it's like the...
Like you can upload a novel a little bit at a time.
Yep, and do it more like a magazine and release it in mm-hmm. bits. So that's where this impact has come, but it doesn't actually say when. So
yeah, it just says in the coming weeks.
In the coming weeks. Thank you, great Zahn, for dialing that in very specifically for everyone. So yeah, if you use Vella, you probably want to know that. And I found it at the KDP community forums. So there you go.
Good to know.
Can we just acknowledge that was probably the worst I ever did on a news story? Thanks, Olivia. Yeah. It's your fault.
It's all my fault.
Lies. No, I think that was more just because neither of us have ever used Vella, so we're not super familiar with it. We know about it, but the details are a little beyond us.
Indeed. Oh, speaking of which, did you want to just jump in with the extra news story that you gave me that I forgot to add to the show notes?
Sure.
Go for it.
I can do that. All right. So I'll go ahead and mention this next one first. So we talked about this a little while back about Books a Million and they're rolling out the same day delivery. Apparently that is live now. They partnered with Walmart. So it's only at 231 of its locations. Does it give like a map or anything to tell you?
No, it says it's nationwide. I think it's probably a safe assumption that if you have a Books a Million and you're living in a large metropolis area, you probably can get same day delivery.
Yeah. So apparently it's only if you order before 3 p.m. it will be delivered the same day.
So that's pretty cool.
So, yeah.
We want Barnes & Noble and Books a Million to succeed, I think. And I think they need to try new things. And this seems like a smart way to compete with Amazon, right? Because, you know, price wise, they're probably going to be comparable for getting a new book. But until this, Amazon could get it delivered to you quicker than Books a Million. And you'd probably, you know, Books a Million was counting on people walking into the stores more than online sales. So hopefully this will boost their online sales. That was a strange noise. And I don't know which one of us it came out of.
Yeah, you became a robot on my end.
Yeah, you sounded like a robot to me. That was me quietly opening the chat being like, is it just me? Is it
me? No, he was definitely a robot on my end as well.
Oh, man. Sadly, it's not going to record it that way, so darn.
No one gets the pleasure of hearing robot, Phil.
No.
In our next news story, I am now a robot.
The best alien hunters are robots.
That's true. So I mentioned this a little while back. Campfire is one of those like writing softwares that's trying to compete with Scrivener. Mm-hmm. And they do an interesting thing where they add in a bunch of like world building modules, as they call them. And so like you can just get the manuscript module and just work on your book if you don't want all the extras. Or if you want all of your notes in one place, you can buy like all their separate modules for the world building stuff. They kind of push the subscription model, but you can change it to a one-time price if you want on their website. Anyway, that's just to explain who they are. The cool thing they've done, I just got the email about it today, is they've made it to where people, like authors who write on Campfire, or even if you don't use Campfire, you can publish through their kind of own reading app thing. And so like as a reader, you can go into the app store right now and buy the Campfire reading app and then read self-published books by tons of different authors. But an interesting thing they're including is if the author put all the world building stuff in Campfire, they can choose to give the readers access to that. So you can have like all the character sheets and the world lore and, you know, stuff about, you know, languages and cultures and religions and all sorts of stuff. So yeah, it was just kind of different and interesting, I thought. But yeah, as far as publishing on there, they had a really neat thing where they, I think it was like 80% or more royalties, I think, for authors. And then don't require exclusivity. So if you publish on, you know, Amazon, Kobo, you know, whatever, you can also publish on Campfire.
Yeah. So if you're going wide, you probably should use it. Like, why wouldn't you? Right.
Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. And for our next news story, Penguins Unite. Three former Penguin Random House senior leaders, two of whom served as CEO or at one time or another. Oh my gosh, I still can't talk. Three penguins have waddled together to form a new publishing company called Authors Equity. And it seems like their goal is to focus the publishing house on taking better care of authors, giving authors a higher royalty rate, but serving as a traditional publisher. They've had a number of big name involved. Goodness. They have had a number of big name author investors, including Tim Ferriss, who wrote the 5-Hour Work Week. And they've already started hiring a bunch of staff, all of which are coming from Big Five publishers. So they have a ton of experience from the Big Five side of it. But they're going to try to do royalties and some things different and see if they can't shake things up a little bit. So that's kind of cool.
Nice. Are they going to operate like the Big Five where like they require agented submissions or does it even say
I don't think it didn't go into any of that at this point. The one thing it did call out is they're going to move away from like advances and instead of paying advances, just increase the royalty rate and hopefully pay on time, right?
Oh, yeah. You'd hope so.
It's a good place to start.
I've gotten a little, what would you call it? Backdoor information. Sort of like since I started my new jobs, kind of seeing that behind the scenes stuff with advances and paying on time or not paying on time. So that's been fun.
I feel like there should be a specific bank for jobs like authors where it's like, if you aren't getting an advance, you still need to live. So this is how to get a loan for a specific, you know, like almost like a grant for living expenses while you're actually doing the book.
Right.
Yeah, that is something JH has long advocated for. I've just said we need somebody rich to adopt us.
Yeah, patron of the arts. I was just going to say, I just had a long discussion with someone about the idea of patron of the arts versus sugar parent. I was like, because they were describing a patron of the arts, but using sugar parent language. I was like, no. That's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I'm fine with it either way, frankly. It's, you know.
Yep. Oh my gosh. Well, I was just going to add to that on a more serious note. I've always loved that idea of having, like, you know, the rich patron, you know, because you see that in like some of the Victorian novels where it's like an artist or a musician or an author, and they've got this, you know, patron who just covers all, you know, their expenses and whatnot so they can just focus on their art. I'm like, why can't I have this?
Right?
Yeah.
This would be so nice.
Do you know what I hear?
What?
It sounds like there's a train coming.
Well, I don't hear it.
You don't hear it? We'll just start covering it. Well, forget I said anything. Start covering the news story, and then I'll point it out again when you can definitely hear it.
Oh, for this last one?
Ugh, yeah, I said
this one isn't even news.
I stitched you up so bad. Silly. I knew you were going to love this one. I was like, here's this one's for you. And then I was just going to mute myself and let you have your fun.
So he's presenting this as news. It's not news. It's just people misunderstanding.
It was on English. NPR.
I know. So the news apparently is that according to Webster, it's okay to end sentences with prepositions. But if you've actually studied the English language, like you should already know this. Because that the whole reason that started, and it goes into it a little bit in this link, was that it was trying to, like, so I guess that's a rule in Latin, and they were trying to match English language rules to the Latin language rules, but, like, you don't have to do that.
Oh, yeah. Anyway. That's really cool.
Yeah. So you have, I know I've seen memes about that where it's like people trying to avoid putting prepositions at the end of sentences and then someone comparing to them, like, now you sound like a butler or whatever. It's like, I don't know, some weird random thing like that. But yeah, it's just one of those things, like it goes back to one of my pet peeves that Phil and I were talking about earlier, where it's just like, it feels like one of these things, like we were taught in like elementary school and middle school English and like the teachers were so focused on teaching us the rules that a lot of us just didn't pay attention to like when you use the rules or what's actually rule and what's not. And so then we're just like repeating these things to each other that aren't actually accurate.
I'm always confused when it says like the way that this article is.
That's definitely a train.
Hear it now.
Hold that thought. Don't lose it, Olivia. It's time for a train ad. Best train ad ever coming up.
Are you experiencing hairy feet, an adventurous itch, or butt pain? Then you should buy a copy of J.H. Fleming's latest novel, Music the Gathering, A Most Unusual Assassin. What does a fantasy novel have to do with those conditions, you ask? Nothing. But it's so damn good you'll forget all about your furry little hobbit feet. Don't wait. Buy it now and tell your doctor how awesome it is. Side effects may include magical adventure, hours of introverted fun, great characters, tears of joy, and death. Buy it now.
Linguistic geek rant continued.
Yeah, I was just thinking that I always crack up when people say you can or you can't do things in language, like how this article says you can do this. And I'm like, well, of course we can. We have been doing it and no one's misunderstood us. But I was thinking about how infrequently now I will read a novel, especially a simple fiction, like a realistic fiction novel that does follow rules of grammar. Like the book that I just finished reading, I'm going to forget the author, but it's The Bee Sting. I know that it was won a lot of awards last year. But each character, it takes place from different perspectives, and each character has a different grammar style. And it really got me thinking, like, when was the last time I read a realistic fiction novel that was perfect, quotes, perfect grammar through the entire thing? Mm-hmm. No, it's like stylized. Mm-hmm. I think stylized.
Yeah. I was going to say, I was, when you said that, author, I should say, who came to mind is Mark Helprin. I don't know if you've ever read any of his stuff, but he does more literary fiction. Reading that guy is like reading like the most decadent, perfect conglomeration of words I've ever read. And sometimes like you even have to like read them a few times, be like, wait, what is he saying here? But it's not because like he's hard to understand. It's just like he is such a master of the language and words that like he's putting them in orders and using words you've never heard of. And it's like, I don't know. Just read one of his books. They're amazing. I say all of that to say, he was the one who came to mind. So I'm like, I don't know if I've ever, like, he doesn't do the kind of like the modern slang stuff, like maybe in dialogue, but not in the actual like narrative itself. And if you're going to read one of his books, I highly recommend Winter's Tale, which focuses on New York. So that's fun.
Oh yeah. They made them. I was like, why does that sound familiar? The movie.
Yeah, they made a movie. It's the stereotypical, like you see the iceberg above the ocean and then you see the giant iceberg below the ocean. It was one of those sorts of things where they left out so much.
Gotcha. So,
yeah.
I have to read it.
All right. Well, shall we move on to our tools?
Sure.
Okay. It's me. I'm the tool.
I am officially done with coffee.
Of course I recorded it. I never take out bloopers. Even the stuff where you're like, take that out. Do not put it in the podcast. I'm like, okay. And then I don't. I'm looking. I see your face right now. I never do that. That's not true.
Uh-huh. So you will do that for our guests who ask it, but not me.
Different rules.
Different rules. Yeah. Different rules for sure. Any Hizzle, do you want to introduce our tool segment?
What did we decide we're talking about? Phelan Atticus?
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess that's the introduction.
So did you already hit go?
Yeah, we've been recording this whole time.
Oh my God.
And it's all staying in. I'm not deleting any of this either. Even the part where you're like, I'm done with coffee.
That was the first thing. That was why you didn't see the countdown, because you had your head tilted way up to the ceiling finishing your coffee.
Yeah, that's what happened. Yeah. Okay, gotcha. Well, I guess we'll be talking about Vellum and Atticus, which I guess you can call them both formatting software, though Atticus is also trying to be a Scrivener-Vellum hybrid sort of thing. So I haven't used that one at all.
Well, we've talked about Vellum before, but specifically why we wanted to talk about them both tonight, which worked out with Olivia on, because she just got Atticus and has been messing around with that. And then obviously I just bought Atticus. And then we just did my book in Vellum, so I got to see both of them live and in person. And let me tell you, if you've never spent the 12 hours uploading a Word document to the great Zon for it to spit it back out at you with the new errors so that you can upload it again and find new errors and just spend your whole day doing that. I mean, honestly, the nicest thing was a few years ago they made it where you could just upload the PDF, and that reduced the pain quite a bit. But if you ever sat there and tried to upload a Word document, it literally you could spend all day and you'd load it in the preview and be like, dang, it's still broken. So either tool is going to save you. If you're going the indie route, like I think it's probably almost a must have one of them, but they do run very similarly. You know, JH obviously has the experience with Vellum. So we loaded my book in there in what, probably an hour and a half, maybe, and we were done, if even that, an hour?
Maybe closer to an hour. It wasn't that long. Probably because there were two of us messing with it. So, like, I knew which buttons to push, but you knew what you wanted things to look like. Yeah. So that, I think, slowed it down a little bit.
Yeah.
Where we're having to work together.
Now, I think Atticus would be just as quick from a formatting standpoint, and either option allows for a lot of pretty formats and things, but neither are 100% customizable. They both have like customizable options where you can do things, but you're not going to be able to add your own fonts and things like that. Somebody really geeky explained it to me the other day why they think that is. I'm not going to try to regurgitate that because I still don't understand. But I think either tool will serve you well. The one thing that Vellum gets a thumbs up for me, and it might just be the way we did it, but because we were on JH's MacBook, she was able to export from Scrivener a Vellum copy of Scrivener. And so when we uploaded it into Vellum, it already knew the chapters and everything. Whereas when I tried to upload into Atticus, it thought my whole book was a chapter. So I would have to like copy and paste each chapter in, which is, you know, it's like an extra 10 minutes to do that or something. But otherwise, I think both are solid.
Yeah. I will say, as far as the customizable fonts and images and whatnot, Scrivener is still the winner. That's what I did for the Music the Gathering novels and how I got you guys your individual chapter headings and scene breaks. I can do that in Scrivener. I can't do that in any of the other formatting softwares.
That's awesome. One of those things that I mentioned earlier that I didn't know what I didn't know until I got there was that I hired the artist to do the cover before I started formatting the book.
Uh-oh.
And she asked, what are the dimensions of the book? And I said, oh, that's a good question. And I looked up what most like crime detective mystery novels are and said, okay, that'll be it. And I gave it to her, not realizing that that's not one of the options in Scrivener. So I had already knocked that off my list. Like, great. So I won't be using that one. Yeah. And so then I decided to go between Vellum and Atticus. And because I'm a first timer, I decided to go with Atticus because of the $100 difference in price tag.
Sure.
And the, if I'm completely lost, they have a 30-day money back guarantee. So I was like, okay, nice. Okay. We've got some, what are they called? Like crash pads in place.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have the same problem I had where it thought your whole book was a chapter, or was it able to pull it up as chapter by chapter?
I haven't uploaded it yet. I'm still looking at YouTube tutorials stage. But,
do you mean you didn't just open it, upload your document, and see what happened?
I should.
What does this button do?
Sometimes I like the crash dummy approach to things.
Full forward.
Yeah.
Go.
I'm going to say this for Atticus, though, and it's, I mean, I don't know. Sorry, Dave Chesson. I don't know why they're trying to compete with Scrivener and make this like, I mean, I know they want to be like an all-in-one tool, but you will never convince me to write in a web browser. It is just not going to happen.
Yeah. That's my thing, is that I wasn't looking for a word processor, because when it comes to very simple tools, and by simple tools, I include in that email, I include word processing and like spreadsheets. I feel like there are so many companies out there that offer fancy ways to do those three things. Whereas always I just want the simplest version that I can customize. So yeah. So I was like, Google Docs, Word, just Word. That's fine by me.
Now, if you will say though, if you do like really dig into this writing thing, Scrivener is pretty amazing. Because it's like that. It's pretty simple, but has everything you could want from a novel standpoint built into it pretty much. It's really nice.
Right.
It's good to know.
Yeah, the being able to compare like say chapters or even different drafts side by side and have my notes up in a corner, like that was it for me. It's like, yes, I want all of this. The only thing I wish it did, and I actually was doing some research on this, was it doesn't do well with like collaborations. So like say you're writing a book with another author, because Phil and I have talked about this before. The best we can come up with is like, you know, I write my chapter and I send the whole file to him and then he writes his chapter. Whereas like being able to, you know, have both of us writing at the same time with everything synced would be preferable. And I actually did find, I came across a software, it was B something, but it was way overpriced, but like I watched a video about it and like it would fix all the collaboration issues and had lots of cool stuff, but yeah, it's way too much. So keep an eye on it in case it ever changes.
Yeah. And then just circling back around, I mean, I guess you did make a good point, is if somebody's already got Scrivener and they didn't want to spend the money on Vellum or Atticus, you can do your formatting in there. It's better than doing it in Word, and you probably won't re-upload 100 times. You'll probably have to re-upload like 5 or 6 times getting everything sorted out the way you want it, which is still way less annoying than the 12 hours I spent the first time I self-published a book. So It was brutal. Like, I literally was an all-day thing. And it, because you would, like, I'd upload it, and you wait 30 seconds for it to upload or whatever, you know, and it uploads, and you wait for, like, 2 minutes for the launch, the preview to launch, and you go, okay. Mm-hmm. And you start back, you start crawling through, and you're like, yep, there's the next mistake. And, like, you try to do them all, but then you just create more mistakes, so that you end up just, like, going page by page by page. It's brutal.
Right.
I look forward to this. This is my future.
I think Atticus will take care of you. I think you will zip right through. I will tell you this, when you go to, are you putting it on the Great Zaun?
Yes.
Okay. When you go to do the paperback, upload a PDF and you'll get it on the first try. If you try to upload a Word doc, that's where you run into the like, oh, I need to redo this 18 million times. Mm-hmm. So this one, we spit it out of Vellum.
Vellum. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I'm never having an episode where we talk about Vella and Vellum on the same episode again. So we spent like the hour and a half getting my book formatted. And we needed to do that so I could go to my cover artist and tell her how many pages it was and all the dimensions and things, right? And then once we were done with that, we had another few minutes of just a little cleanup or whatever. The actual files, once we finished them, I had no cleanup. The PDF was fine on the first try for the paperback. It was perfect for the ebook on the first try. And this time I had a little minor adjustment I had to do on the cover. I always run into something where even though I give her the dimensions and she makes it perfect fit to size, every time Amazon's like, it doesn't fit. And so then I end up having to go into, there's an easy workaround. I'll just go into the cover creator and choose the template with no images on it and then just delete out all the places they have words. And then it just shucks it that tiny little bit to fit perfectly and then just move right along.
Good tip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I will try to do one at some point. Now that I've paid for Atticus, I will use it and try to do one in there, but definitely was not disappointed with Vellum, and Atticus seemed really easy. All right, on to the next segment.
Sure.
Okay. Hey, JH.
Yeah.
We're recording.
I'm aware.
Okay, good. Just wanted to make sure we're on the same page. For Creatives on Fire this week, we're going to do our two topics, and we'll start with the writing one, which is going to be about cross-branding and sort of random things about selling our books and or other media, yeah?
Yeah.
Which we thought would be fun with Olivia on, and as she already alluded to with the Gumshoe Noir, they're doing the book and the album thing, but then she's also part of Music the Gathering, so she's going to Ren Fairs and performing, but then also selling books there. And yeah, do you just want to just jump in and talk about that experience? And
yeah, absolutely. I feel really lucky because Ren Fairs are one of the few places where, as an artist of any type, you know, there's so many different types of performers mm-hmm. there, you can meet a ton of people in a year and basically see like who's going to come and be interested in my art. And then from those people who are interested in your art, they get to know you a little bit better. And then if you make completely different art, of course, it's going to be a smaller subset, but you still have a pool of people that you can say, like, here you go, like, look at my art, in a way that doesn't require you to immediately go to paid advertising or, you know, pay for conventions and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. it's really lucky to be able to, you know, tap into that audience, mm-hmm. those friends and things like that. And I don't think I truly realized it until we had Music the Gathering's novels from JH, and we realized like, oh, even though this is a completely different medium, all these people are already interested in a piece of this. Mm-hmm. So they want to explore this side of it as well. And so now I'm hoping to have a little bit of that with Gumshoe Noir as well, that the people who enjoyed the music are going to think like, oh, might as well see what this is about, see how this mm-hmm. clicks into it. And see what happens there. And I've been realizing that the more partnerships, the more adaptations you have of something that you're doing, it's just sort of like a big old spider web mm-hmm. that the more right. likely someone's going to find it. And I've been learning a lot. I mentioned at the start that my partner is part of this group. It's a company called Sound Booth Theater that creates audio experiences. So they started with audio books, mm-hmm. but they are now sort of pioneering the idea of cinematic audio. So having something akin to a radio play or a full, like, essentially, like, audible movie version of your book. And the way that they've been talking to people about it is that it is an adaptation. And so to have someone immediately give you an adaptation rather than just like a different format is a great way of opening it up to a different audience of people as well.
Didn't we just hear about Sound Booth Theater at Superstars? Is that who I'm thinking of?
Yes, I believe so. I thought so. I'm going to have to Google it.
Yeah,
right
I'm
now.
Trying to pull up the schedule because I want to see.
Where was Superstars?
Oh, in Colorado Springs.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, it might have been them. They've been lurking at a lot of cons.
Yes, that was them. So Aaron works with them?
Yeah, Aaron's one of their main composers, and he's also on their marketing team.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's amazing. Yeah, they were there. We met, what's his name?
I'm trying to find it right now.
Jeff Hayes,
that
yes.
That sounds right. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Jeff Hayes was there.
Yeah.
That's super cool, yeah. No, we had no idea. No idea that Aaron worked with them. That's super cool.
Fun connections.
Yeah, no, it definitely was. It was Jeff Hayes that was there that we met. Mm-hmm. He came up and talked to us at the
at our the dinner.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
It wasn't the dinner. It was the meetup. That's right.
I'm also just in, like, as a performer, I'm a big dork about immersive stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you can make a novel, if you can have the option to make a novel more immersive, because not everyone is into immersive stuff, I think that's great. So like growing up, I often had a novel, I would associate a novel with a specific album. Like, for example, for some reason, I became obsessed with Kate Bush's The Whole Story while reading Dune. And so those two things are tied together in my mind for all time. Mm-hmm. And so, but there is something to be said. And I also, while reading It, I was listening to Arvo Pärt's, one of his like long musical works. And so I think there is something to be said for creating a multi-sense experience while reading a book.
Yeah.
That's
absolutely
really cool.
I have a similar thing with, one of my favorite book series is The Symphony of Ages, which incorporates a lot of music as well. But when I was reading the final book in the series, which like after, you know, the first, how many books is it? Nine, maybe? After the first eight, and you get to this ninth one, and it's the final thing, and all this really dramatic stuff's happening. And there was a song by Josiane Clarke that just like, it was playing in my head the whole time I was reading this last book. And like now, even like every time I hear that song, I like go through the entire book again in my head with like a scene, like all the major scenes happening. And yeah, I don't know. It's like a weird connection thing where it's like they're related now, like even though they may not even know about each other.
I don't know if this is opening a can of worms for this specific discussion, but I was just thinking, at what point is something, what is the difference between something being merchandise for a specific art piece versus being in a completely different art piece itself? Because I was thinking about like the fact that technically we sell the Music the Gathering novels at our merch table, which feels strange because it's like, it's not like a t-shirt for Music the Gathering. It's a completely different work. Yeah. But in terms of a lot of visual art is sold as merchandise. So you're like, ooh, what is the difference there?
Well, it's thin anyways, because like even if it was like a t-shirt, people are going to buy it because it represents a piece of the artist, or it in of itself is art tied to the artist, right? Mm. So it's a murky line, I think.
Yeah, I think I would say it has to do with like what the artist is creating versus what's kind of just sort of connected to it. So I'm thinking of like, if you're a musician or an author, like your books and your albums are kind of like the core art. And so if you have like a t-shirt that depicts the album, it's like, that's just kind of related, but like, you're not just focused on making t-shirts as your main art. Mm. So that would kind of be the difference for me, I think.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And running along with the sort of theme of like the cross-branding, cross-selling, or even random ways to sell things, like, you know, for, I mean, most of our audience is going to be of the author ilk, right? So it goes to the same thing, right? So JH did her music album, but she launched it alongside a book publication. So that's something somebody could take into account, right? The hope was that if she did them and she did them together, maybe some of her readers would want to hear her sing, right? And then like, you know, for like Olivia, what you do, with Music the Gathering, where you guys go on stage and you put on a incredible performance. Obviously, that drives a lot of people to want to buy the albums and things. So I guess what I'm saying is, anybody out there, if you want to cross promote, start a band, join the Ren Faire circuit. I guess is what I'm saying.
Yep.
Yeah.
Or like our equivalent, like for me, you know, a lot of the conventions that we've gone to in the past, especially ones we would go to a lot, they would start using me as like a game show person or have me do goofy skits or things. And I never mind, and I still don't mind, because like the ones I go to where I have a publisher, whenever we've done that, I've inevitably sold a lot of books, right? I always think of SoonerCon many moons ago when Assassins Incorporated first came out, and my publisher had me get up on stage with her and we read a part of the book where the main character was talking to his mom, and I did the narrator voice and the character and she did the mom and went way over the top and we had everyone laughing. And when we finished, I thought I was done. And so I slipped out of the room and she raced off stage and made a whole big deal about chasing me down and like screaming in front of everybody that I wasn't done. And they made me get back up on stage and they were making me do an interpretive dance to like a Wizard of Oz story. And everyone was laughing and carrying on. And there was this huge crowd because they had us backed up to the art gala. So like all these people from the art gala coming out. So there's like, I don't know, 100 people watching this or something. And there was a line in there about like Dorothy kicking off a slipper. And I thought it'd be cute to just kick off my shoe off the stage and get a few cheap chuckles.
Uh-oh.
The problem was the shoe hung on my foot and it shot out into the crowd like a missile. And it pelted this poor lady in the chest. And everyone died laughing. Like they thought I did it on purpose. They couldn't believe I did it, but it was hilarious. The next morning when I walked down into the vendor room, all my books were sold.
Wow.
Yeah, gone, done. They sold out.
Okay, let me take notes really quick. So yeah. To sell lots of books, kick a lady in the face with a shoe. Okay.
Nailed it. I'm pretty sure I've seen you kick a lady or two in the face with a shoe at your shows.
It wasn't at Oklahoma. I did kick a child in the head, and my bandmates will never let me live it down.
That's too good.
She just came up on stage behind me and I had no idea she was there.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's too funny. I can remember you getting up there by yourself because the other two were sick and you just totally ran a whole set, a whole day, like multiple sets by yourself.
Yeah, that's why when you said, hey, I don't have our notes for this podcast episode yet, I was like, you want me to wing it? I can wing it if you want me to wing it.
No, I never would have said that. Obviously, I had the show notes prepared for days.
Of course, of course. Months ahead of time.
This is the height of professionalism. I guess the message we're trying to get across is there are different ways to promote yourself, right? You don't, if you're going the author route, you don't just have to do the boarding thing where you, you know, beg a bookstore to let you do a book signing and then sit at a table by yourself and feel sad inside. there's different ways you can get out there and do things. And do you have other talents? Do you have other skills? Are there weird groups you're a part of that you can tap into?
Yeah, can you mesh them together somehow? Mm-hmm. Have them feed off each other?
Hey, now I'm going to be way closer to you guys. And if you're worried you're going to be alone at a table near where you guys live, like, call me up and I'll be there. Yeah. And I'll clone myself a couple times.
Nice.
Speaking of, I have something to ask you about when we're done.
Oh.
Oh, weird. It's going to be awkward. That's why we're not going to have that on the recording. What was I've already forgotten what our other topic was. Oh, for the finance side of the podcast, we're going to talk about debt a little bit. So, Olivia, we've done this theme this year where we've kind of broken up all the financial independent stuff and the writing stuff into these little kind of segments. We're trying to hit a little piece each week. So we've talked about like saving and knowing how much you need to be able to retire early and value-based spending and that sort of a thing. And I think we've naturally progressed to talking about debt, which I always say like debt equals future on fire because that's just how I view it. You know, I would much rather have my money be saved and invested in making more money than losing more money because I have to pay interest in things. And, you know, the whole concept that of bringing financial independence discussion discussion into the writing podcast is it's really like became a thing where it's like, oh, this is a second way we can achieve our dream, right? It doesn't just have to be that we become a best-selling author who makes millions and millions of dollars a year. We could also achieve the life we want by not spending money on stupid things and saving and investing and being wise. So I think the budding author could do worse than to just get rid of any and all debt and avoid it if they can. What's it like for a musician, though?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, it's funny you say that because I was just hearing about a literary convention where one of the authors got up there and said, and then I just committed myself to just getting out of debt. And so I got out of debt. And everyone was like, does this person realize how privileged that sounds? But okay.
Right.
Yeah.
As a musician, it's interesting because I also have the panic of the future on fire thing. And mm-hmm. But because our work isn't consistent, it's not like we're making the same thing every week.
Right.
It can be scary and you have to really like categorize things correctly. Mm-hmm. Like this past year we went on hiatus because we had just basically been going nonstop since I would say November of 2020. And, you know, it wore on us and we're like, we need to take a break. So I had to, while I was buying Christmas presents in December, take some moments to breathe and remind myself that I was going to start working again in January mm-hmm. in a way that I'm guessing is similar to someone who's, you know, writing books and they're like, okay, mine will be done soon, which gives me mm-hmm. the promise of hopefully income. But I discovered early on as a musician that I'm lucky enough that with enough rent fares, all year rent fares, I can make enough to live without incidents. And mm-hmm. that's not cozy for me. So I agree with you guys 100%. And I actually was just talking to someone about this the other day that I feel like we're destroying the hierarchy of the full-time artist being above the part-time artist. Mm-hmm. That now, especially because we can work remotely, that if you can have support and security in having another job, it mm-hmm. doesn't make you less than someone who's doing something full time. It just
sure.
makes you financially safe. Yeah. So I do. I have a part time job during the week that I do. Just, you know, digital marketing management kind of stuff.
Sure. Oh, and that's why I wanted to bring it up that way, because it's like, I think, I don't know, it's weird. It's like weird in that it feels like we always from the outside looking in, we think it's like a zero sum game. Like, I either will make a bazillion dollars or I will be the starving artist. Like, there's nowhere in between and there's no way to be in between, right? I think there is an image, especially in today's world, to your point, right? Because mm-hmm. there's so many things you can do from home, so many different ways to approach it. And so that was one of the themes from a week ago, 2 weeks ago or something, was talking about like part of the reason why you have to be really on point with your finances and things is because what if you do have a big windfall, but that windfall is only for today and, you know, next month it's mm-hmm. not, right? Mm-hmm. And how do you manage through that? And that's why you have to really pay attention to your living expenses. And then, you know, everybody's in a different place, right? And obviously some people are in a much tougher spot than others. But if you're in a place where you're pursuing an artistic endeavor, you're pursuing this dream, then it makes sense to keep your expenses as low as possible and save as much as possible on the backside. And yeah, so then it's like naturally comes to like, well, what about debt? Like, well, if you can avoid it, that's ideal, you know? Mm-hmm. It's one less millstone to have around your neck.
I do know sometimes it's just not avoidable, which is how I first ended up with it. It's like when I first got out of college and was starting my first job and got my own apartment and just trying to build up any sort of, you know, my own finances, because my ex and I had just split as well. So basically had nothing starting off. And so, like, yeah, I got approved for a credit card, and that's how I paid for pretty much everything because I didn't have another way. So
yeah,
it does happen sometimes. Like, that's just the situation you are dealing with, and you just do what you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that there's sometimes it's hard to even put in the time to research this stuff because there is that sort of despair that comes with debt. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times there are organizations or just like, basically, there are ways to refinance things so that you're not like, I'm going to be paying these debts off for the next 30 years.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's nice to just like take a breath and be able to say like, okay, let's do some deep research into this and see how we can make this even a little bit better. But right. it's tough, and it sucks because the part of the country that does not have debt, sometimes they don't realize that it's not a moral failing, that it is a system failing. Mm-hmm. I say this because my host, who I'm currently with, is a part of a book club of a lot of like wealthy, like blue-haired ladies. And they just read a book where the main character had a bunch of student loans at the age of like 40. And the woman was like, that seems unreasonable. And that's like, ooh, that seems like lazy or something like that. And my host had to be like, excuse me? Like, are you completely out of touch with how the country was working right now?
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing I always like to... like try to point out and put a big light bulb on. And it goes more to like, if you find yourself in a spot where like you don't have debt right now, but you know, you might be looking at something in the future, or maybe you have some money and you're like, well, I can afford to spend it. One of the things like I always like to point out is, and of course it would be better if I'd done my homework and done the math exactly, but I've done it before and it works out pretty good. So like, let's say you're looking at like, you know, you want to buy a car, right? And let's say that the car costs, let's say it's $20,000, right? And the most normal American thing would be like, okay, can I afford the payments? Okay, cool. I can afford the payments, or I can't, so I can't get that car, right? Or I have to get something different. But if you can and you take it on, then what actually ends up happening, and obviously all the terms are different and interest rates are different and stuff, but for all intents and purposes, let's say probably on average, give or take, if it's a $20,000 car, by the time you're done making payments, you're probably going to pay 26, 28, maybe 30 grand for it by the time it's all said and done. So the other option that's out there, and people don't realize this, is like if you have that space ahead of time, right? So when I paid off my car, what I did was I just continued paying myself the car payment. And then I started investing that same amount. And if you know, were to invest the same amount over, and obviously that may not work out perfectly because you might go like, well, 4 years into it or whatever, I don't have quite the money, but I do need the car or whatever. But let's say you're able to start that and you're investing that money and you're putting it in like an S&P 500 or something like that, right? And it's returning its average 8% a year or whatever. By the time you got the money, you might get to that 20 grand, but only have put like 15 in and be able to go buy your car outright. And it ended up costing you half as much because you never took the loan. And in fact, you did the reverse. You paid yourself and invested it and grew the money to the point you needed, which seems unrealistic, but it is possible, you know, depending on obviously your circumstances and things, right?
It is tricky as a, you know, like a 1099 or self-employed person to mm-hmm. work out that kind of stuff, especially when you don't really know exactly how taxes are going to work out. But I know someone who just every paycheck he got, but he was self-employed, he would put 25%. Just like that, I can't touch that, which of course mm-hmm. doesn't work if you need that money to pay for food and the roof above your head. But he just like pretended that money didn't exist and then was able to buy his first car at the end of that year.
Nice.
So it's nice to just have that. This is my investment in my future money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. JH, anything you want to add?
I'm just wondering what you're doing over there. Like bumping all sorts of stuff and scratching your desk. And
I was tapping my knee like this. I'm doing weird stuff. It's creepy. I'm sorry. When I was playing with my lid.
Is that what you were scraping across your desk?
Oh, probably. Was it making scraping noises?
A little bit.
I was really thinking and being terrible at podcasting, apparently. I think we made it to the end.
Thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just going to add, I talked a little bit about my experience with debt, and I would just add that I did get out of it, and I know, you know, everyone's circumstances are different, like we've said, but it is possible, and it may take years of, you know, hard work and toil and whatnot, but it is possible. And just to keep working on it if you are in that situation.
Yeah, it's super nice once you get there, too. It's like, I can live so cheap now.
Yes, you quickly learn, like, oh, I don't have to buy these things that I want.
Yay. I can live on beans. It's fine. All right. Well, I think that sadly brings us up towards the end. Olivia, tell the peoples where to find you.
Well, you can find my band, Music the Gathering, at Music the Gathering Band on all the social channels. You can find Gumshoe Noir at Gumshoe Noir Music. Oh, wait. Or is it at Gumshoe Noir? I think it's at Gumshoe Noir. I should know my At Gumshoe Noir at all the things. And then Folk Files is, you can find it on all podcast platforms. It's Folk Files, F-I-L-E-S, not like Greek for liking folk. and or at Folk Files Podcast on all the things.
Do you have any idea on like when the book will be out and where people will be able to find it?
I'm hoping within 3 months. I'm hoping by the summer you'll be able to get it. Probably easiest place would be Amazon.
Nice. All right, JH.
You can find me at jhfleming.net. I'm on all the social media as JH Fleming. If you need an editor, I'm on Fiverr as JH Fleming. My band Wildwood Minstrels are on all the music places. And we'll be at SoonerCon in June. I don't have anything until
then. Oh, man,
that's
already coming up. We're going to the Ren Fair.
Yeah, I will be at the Ren Fair in Minnesota.
As will chimney Olivia. Cakes. Chimney cakes. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited.
Me too.
Oh, that's so funny. And I am Philip Dreher Duncan, philipdreherduncan.com. And I heard a rumor that the first in the Blade Mage series is going to be 99 cents next week. So when this airs, it'll be 99 cents. So yeah, go buy it if you haven't yet. And if you have, we'll go buy it for somebody else and send it to them. All right. This has been another episode. Thank you, Olivia.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And wait, no, don't leave. Hit stop. There we go. Down.